Les conférences du Collège de France.
It's a pleasure to welcome Carlos Carl Lindgren, who is a professor and at Uppsala University and deputy head of the Department of Government. Carlos Carl's research interests include political participation and representation, democratic theory, EU politics, and education policies. Is the co-author of the book entitled Participatory Governance in the EU, Enhancing and Endangering Democracy and Efficiency. You have co-authored and co-authored more than 36 articles, chapters, scientific reports on various topics. Your academic work has appeared in leading general and political science journals such as Nature, the American Political Science Review, the American Journal of Political Science, and the Journal of Politics. In 2009, you received Uppsala University's Distinguished Teaching Award for your outstanding accomplishments in undergraduate teaching. And you have also been awarded the SAGE Best Paper Award and the Lawrence Longley Best Article Award by the American Political Science Association. And you will give us two presentations. Today, you will tell us, you will talk about perpetuity of the past, how political inequality is transmitted across generations. I won't be take any longer, and I give you the floor. And you have 1 hour. And now I'll start taking notes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Great pleasure to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Voilà.
So nice to be here. I have to apologize, I don't speak any French. I took a class for 3 weeks. That would be a very short speak if I try to speak in French, but I'm going to speak in Swenglish instead. Hopefully you're going to understand me. But the topic of this lecture, as I said, is the perpetuity of the past. And more precisely, we are concerned about what could be said the essence of democracy. So if you had this idea, what is it really that democracy is about? A common answer to that question is that the essence of democracy is that all citizens living in a society, they should have equal and adequate opportunities to participate and influence public decisions. It doesn't mean that all individuals has to be equally politically active. It only means that they should have the same means to be politically active, should they so prefer. So in that sense, democracy rest on the principle of equality of opportunity rather than an equality of outcome. However, like all important concepts, the exact meaning of equality of opportunity is obviously contested. What is it actually required for something to fulfill the principle of equality of opportunity? There are many answers to that question. But one influential answer advocated, for instance, by the economist John Römer, is that equality of opportunity, it requires that the distribution of different important outcomes should not depend on factors that we as individuals do not have direct control over. But as all good answers, obviously that answer raises many new questions. What are these exact circumstances that we as individuals lack control over? I guess we can spend the next hour trying to agree on an answer to that question. Try to make this long list of these circumstances that we cannot control. But that will not be the purpose of the lecture. Hopefully, unfortunately, I would argue, we don't need to agree on that. We only need to agree on one thing in order to have a topic for this lecture, and that is that very few of us have any direct control over the identity of our parents. That is, we do not get to pick or choose who our parents are, which I know at least my daughter sometimes thinks is a pity. But the thing is that who our parents are is outside the control of us as individuals. And turning back to the question of democracy, that also requires that family background should not depend, should not influence who get political influence or political power in democracy. And obviously, family background has no such importance, because in the democracy, we are all equal. But I guess we can just look at this picture, and we see that apparently some individuals are a bit more equal than others. So I think it's enough to give a names like this. We have the Gandhis, the Bush, the Trudeaus, and the Le Pens. In order to understand, it's very difficult to think that this can happen by random chance. If family background is not important for the distribution of political power in democracy, it's very baffling, I would argue, that we have these parents and children on these important positions in these very large countries. And this is just a few stupid examples, but over the years, there is increasing evidence that children grow up to resemble their parents, not only socially and politically, but also politically. That is, it tends to be the case that individuals who are politically active get children who are also politically active themselves. And if we go back to the idea of democracy and think, is that a problem? I guess one problem with democracy is that we see here and now that some people are more influential than others. That might be a problem. But an even bigger problem, especially for sort of the starting point of equality of political opportunity, that is obviously if these kind of disadvantages or advantages that accrue to the individuals in one particular generation are also passed on to the heirs of future generations. Because then these kind of disadvantages or advantages in terms of political influence are going to carry through time in a rather discomforting manner. So if you're looking at this kind of idea that who our parents are matters for our political influence, it has some disturbing parallels with the kind of pre-democratic societies against which democratic revolutions were once fought. So obviously, in order to sort of make democracy more sort of vivid and alive, it would be good if you somehow could try to mitigate or take different kind of actions or invoke certain policies that could combat this kind of reproduction of politically inequality transmitting across generations. But obviously, in order to take these kind of measures and invoke these kind of policies, we need to have a good understanding on the mechanisms underlying these kind of sort of persistence of political inequality in democracies. Because obviously the mechanism for this is not the same as it used to be in these old pre-democratic regimes. But these kind of persistences across generations now take new forms. And the question that we're going to discuss today is, what is it that drives this transmission of political inequality across generations? So this is the question that I have sort of paid some attention in my recent research together with colleagues, where we have tried to fill this gap, because I would argue that we still have a rather poor understanding of the roots of this kind of intergenerational persistence of political equality. So that is what I'm going to discuss today. Today we're going to be a bit boring and mainly sort of look at the problem and try to see how grave is the problem. What is that causes this problem? Tomorrow, hopefully, if some of you come back, then we try to be more constructive and ask the question, but hey, is there anything we can do about this? Is there a way to reduce the importance of family background in modern democracies when it comes to the distribution of political influence? And in particular, we're going to look at one factor, one kind of policy, and that is improved educational opportunities. Because being in a hall like that, we all like to think that education should matter for these kind of questions, don't we? And if you come back tomorrow, I'm going to tell you whether or not we are correct in hoping that. But today I will instead focus on sort of the research I have done together with my colleagues, looking at sort of the mechanisms underlying this kind of persistence in political participation and influence across generations. And all of my research on this issue, even though I often talk about participation and influence, you're going to see that it focuses on participation, not on influence. And I guess there are multiple reasons for that, but the most important is that influence is incredibly difficult to measure and observe. But I would argue that there are good sort of reasons for studying participation as well. Because if you think about democracy, what is the most natural way to have political influence? That should be through participation. It could be by throwing a vote in an election, or it could be sort of standing for office or even holding political office. So participation is incremental to the way that you get political influence in a democracy. And we know from plenty of research that individuals who participate less, they'll run the risk of getting their preferences and interests neglected in the political process. So if you're not there at the table when the decisions are made, there is a big risk that you're going to lose out on the resulting policies. So that's the reason why we're going to focus on participation. And also, of course, because it's much easier to measure participation than influence. So we're going to study different types of participation. Most likely, and most, well, mostly focused on is voting in elections, but also whether or not you're nominated or elected to political office on different levels. But before getting into this empirical analysis, we should start in asking, but what are these different theoretical mechanisms that can cause these kind of persistence in political participation across generations? What can drive this observation that we have, that politically active parents are more likely to get children that are politically active themselves? What drives this parent-child correlation in political participation? Looking back at the research on this issue, there are three main theoretical suggestions here. The first one is the upper curved arrow, saying it's about status transmission. We know from plenty of research in sociology and economics that we as parents tend to pass on our social status to our children. It could be in terms of education, it could be in terms of income, wealth, or occupational status, or different things. But we know there is a strong intergenerational correlation in these kind of status positions. And we also know as political scientists that the strongest determinant of political participation in all countries, all time periods, is the social status of individuals. That's pretty much as close as it comes to social universal law in political science. People are better educated, have higher incomes and better jobs. They tend to participate more politically than the less fortunate peers. So it could be the case then that this correlation in voting or political candidacy between parents and children could be driven by this kind of status transmission. That is, that we as parents pass on our social status to our children. But it sounds a bit boring if that would be the entire story. So obviously, there are other possibilities. One possibility is that it could also be about social learning. That actually, the social learning focuses on the fact that parents teach their children how to behave through instruction and observation. That is, politically active political parents, they can teach the importance of political participation by telling the children how important it is that you engage in society, or you can just teach them that by taking them with you to the political meetings or when you go to vote on the election day. So the idea here is that there's also this possibility of social learning, so that parents teach their children how to behave politically by being teachers and role models. So that's second. Both of these focus on the social environment. That is, the idea is that we as a parent, we pass on the social environment to our children, And that social environment can be more or less conducive to political participation. And that was long the dominant story in this field, but then come along this new field of behavioral genetics and saying, hey, it's not only the case that we as parents pass on the social environment to our children, we also pass on our genes. And the question is, why should that matter for political participation? It's not the case, obviously, there are going to be some specific genes sort of programming you for voting or standing for political office. But there's still plenty of evidence that many complex social traits like these, like voting, like becoming a politician, they can have genetic effects. That you have a number of small genetic effects that all work together to create these kind of outcomes, but they do it through all these intermediary factors. And in this case, many believe that one particularly important intermediary factor is different kinds of personality traits. We know that how we are as individuals, if we're outgoing or introvert, whether or not we think it's okay to break norms or not, that is partly sort of inheritable from our parents. It's related to our genetics. And if we also believe that whether or not to participate politically in a democracy can be affected by these kind of personality traits, so the likelihood that we're going to vote or run for political office could depend on how we are as persons, then that obviously opens up the possibility that our genes could also be important for our political behavior. And that also opens up the possibility that this kind of resemblance that we see in the political behavior of children and parents, at least partly, can be due to this kind of genetic transmission. And what I would argue is that since these kind of mechanisms and explanations are pretty different, it could be important to understand how important they are in order to know how to elevate or mitigate this kind of intergenerational political inequality. Because obviously, it could call for different policies depending on whether this correlation is due to status transmission, social learning, or genetic transmission. Perhaps different kind of measures could then be unequally effective in mitigating this, depending on which of these stories is the most empirically accurate. So that's what much of research tried to do. But initially, as I said, if you're looking back, and this is 50 years of research in one slide, but the dominant perspective during the 70s and 80s was it's all about social learning. This entire literature was focused on sort of the political psychology and saying that what matters here is how effective parents are in transmitting their norms and behavior to the children. So there were a lot of focus studying, trying to see what kind of factors are hindering or fostering this kind of transmission from parents to children. And the possibility of status transmission was rarely raised, and I would argue that the issue of genetic transmission was even less rarely raised. But then come along this new research. Some would argue for status transmission and saying that that is very important. But even more so, people started to think about this genetic transmission. And we have this first generation of genetic studies in political in political science, and mainly use twins. Because twins are nice in the way that they are identical. So identical twins are genetically identical. And then you have these non-identical twins that are more like ordinary siblings. And then one can come up with these clever ways trying to decompose and disentangle the differences between these genetic factors and these environmental factors. And what these early twin studies found in the area of political science was that these kind of shared environments didn't matter at all for important political traits such as political participation and political behavior. And that sounds a bit surprising, given that this entire literature were saying that it's all about social learning, a bit about data transmission. And that is exactly that kind of shared environment that the twin studies and this behavioral genetics said that do not matter at all. So we have this completely different literature. Why is one saying that it's all about social learning, the other one saying it's not at all about social learning. And I guess the starting point when me and my colleagues started to work on this was saying that both of these conclusions in these two phases seems a bit non-intuitive. It seems a bit strange that we have these really complex political outcomes like political participation, and it should be entirely driven by the social environment or entirely driven by biology. Complex things, especially when you get older, get a bit more boring, then you often realize that the glass is always half full or half empty. It always depends on many different things. So that's what we started off with this project. And we had this idea that perhaps these very strong conclusions reached in this early research was at least partly due to methodological artifacts. These twin studies, for instance, they rest on extremely stringent assumptions. That is, once these assumptions do not hold or are relaxed, then these nice decomposition results cannot be trusted anymore. So they often a rather difficult way to do this. So what we argue was that the better data methods are needed to make progress on these issues. And that's usually what you argue when you think you have these kind of data and methods to use. And that's what we have. And that's kind of the reason that we're going to focus a lot on Sweden today, not only because I'm from Sweden, but also because I guess one of the comparative advantages of Sweden when it comes to empirical research is that we have very good and sort of huge register data, administrative data they can use for different purposes, because we have this big welfare state and people have these personal numbers, personal identifiers, and all the informations, all the interactions with the welfare state are recorded and linked to these personal numbers. And a good thing is then that this can be used for research purposes because we have access to all this data and we have these unique personal identifiers, which means that we can link these different registers. But obviously we need to do that in a safe way so we don't get direct access to the personal numbers. They're all anonymous by the Statistics Sweden, but it's still possible to link a lot of interesting information across registers. And for this purpose, today, one of the most important things is that we can link almost all individuals born 1932 and later to the parents. So because of that, we have this entire population of Swedes where we can link the parents and the children. We can add various demographic and socioeconomic characteristics from other registers and also historical censuses. So we can go back to censuses from the 60s and 70s and link to this data. And then we also have increased the availability of different measures of political participation. Me and my colleague, they have scanned and digitized the entire electoral rolls for many elections. And we also have complete data on all individuals appearing on party lists or being nominated or elected to political office in Sweden between 1982 and 2022. So based on this data, we thought we have this idea that we should be able to improve the previous research in this area. But then one obviously need to have some kind of methods in order to try to disentangle sort of the social environment, importance of the social environment and the genetic factors. I already said that twin studies was a popular strategy, but they have some obvious problems. But another strategy that were pioneered by some economists, especially in Netherlands, but also in Sweden, they argue that we can look at adoptions, because adoptions in some way construct the natural experiment in this case. What we often have when we're looking at sort of parental transmission is that as a biological parent who also raised our children, we're going to pass on both our genes and the social environment. But the question is, can we come up with an experiment that disentangle these two things? And that is what an adoption study can do under certain assumptions. So in these papers, we have these very long sections discussing these assumptions and trying to argue why we think they hold in the Swedish case. But I will not bore you with all these details here. But really, sort of the idea is not that difficult. What we can do in the registers, since in Sweden until the early 70s, we have mainly domestic adoptions. So international adoptions coming later. Before that was mainly domestic adoptions. And that means that both the biological and adoptive parents were residing in Sweden. So they can be found in our registers. So what we can do then, is we can create two different samples. First, what we call an own birth sample. And that is what we usually do in these kind of studies. Here we have sort of the outcome of an own child, I, that's going to depend on the same outcome among his or her biological parents. And this raw parameter, that's going to be the standard transmission coefficient. That's going to be sort of the correlation between the parental outcome and the child outcome. So if this is voting, this is going to tell us how important the voting behavior of parents are for the children's voting behavior. The problem here is that the rule is going to sort of cover both these pre-birth and post-birth factors. In order to try to disentangle them, we need to go to the adoption sample and utilize the fact that here we have two different kind of parents that contribute different things to the child. First, we have the birth parents, the one who created the child but then adopted it away for some reason. They're going to contribute with the genes. But if these adoptions is occurring very close to the birth of the child, which was usually the case in Sweden, then they will have no social interaction with the child. So there should not be any possibility, for instance, for social learning between the parent and the child. On the other hand, we have these adoptive parents. They are genetically unrelated to the child. And as long as this assignment from adoptive parents to own birth parents is sort of reasonably random, then we can make the assumption that these beta 2 parameters are going to capture the impact of post-birth factors on this kind of social learning. So here we have this idea that since we have these two types of parents, one contributing with the genes, and the other one with the environment, to make it simple, they can try to disentangle and see how important are these two type of factors for the political behavior of the child. And under the assumption that this model is correctly specified, so these kind of terms are enter additively, so a simple sum, and we can separate them, then we're also going to have this relationship that the overall transmission rho is going to equal beta 1 plus beta 2. So that's what we can try to see whether or not that makes sense in our data. So that's what we did. So we had this election data for three different elections, I think, when we did these studies, 1970, 82, 1994, and 2010. It was four elections. And we also have data on sort of whether a child was nominated to political office at the municipality, regional, or national level in Sweden. We also have similar data on whether the parents, both the biological parents and their adoptive parents, were ever nominated to political office. And then we try to see, first of all, do we find evidence of this kind of intergenerational persistence in political participation in a rather equal country like Sweden? Sweden is also still, see how long, a democracy. So that's what's going to help us to see whether or not we can find it. But next thing we're going to see, if there is such a persistence, to what extent can it be explained by these social environmental factors, or these pre-birth, sort of the post-birth factors, or to what extent can it be explained by genetic factors and these pre-birth factors? So that's what we did. We have two different studies. And to make a long story rather short. This is what we found. The left graph is the main results for the voting study. Here we look at voting. The right one is for the candidacy. The y-axis here is simply measuring transmission coefficient. That is simply the regression coefficient, saying that how much are children's turnout increasing when parents' turnout is increasing by one unit? Or how much more likely are individuals to run for political office when their parents run for political office? And what we see here is that in the Omberg sample, that transmission coefficient is about 0.23. Means if you have two voting parents, you're going to turn out 23 percentage more in the election compared to an individual who both of the parents do not vote. So that is measured that there is a correlation in voting behavior between parents and children. But another thing we try to do in this adoptive sample is try to distinguish between the importance of the pre-birth factors, that is the green part of the bar, and the post-birth factors, that is the social environment, measured by this reddish part of the bar. And what we can see here is for voting, both of them matter. They are both statistically significant. I don't show that here. Sort of the pre-birth part counts for about 40% of this entire transmission in the adoptive sample, whereas the post-birth account for about 60%. So we say that if we're going to trust this estimate, about 60% of the correlation is due to the fact of the social environment, that is the adoptive parents, whereas 40% is due to the genetics, that is the biological parents. Looking instead at candidacy, we see that there's even more even split. That's about a 50-50 split. So 50% is due to genetics, 50% due to the social environment. We can also see another thing here. That is, I said that if this model is completely correctly specified, these bars in the adoptive sample should add up to the transmission in the Omberg sample. We see that is not the case in either of these. We come pretty close, but not entirely. There are many reasons, of course, why this could be the case. But one possibility is that this model should not be additive in the sense that we have this genetic and social factors having independent effects on the outcome in question. There is this growing literature on nature-nurture interactions. Obviously, we have even more intricate things going on here. So in the voting study, where we have some better data to work with, we try to see whether or not we could see that. I'm not going into all the details here, and this might be a bit more difficult to see for you. But really what they're saying is that the relative importance of these genetic and social factors, it varies a lot over different social conditions. So for instance, we try to look how does it vary with age, and then we look at the age 18. Then this is the relative importance of the social environment. This small white one is the relative importance of genetic factors. So we see when individuals are very young, in this case, still living with their adoptive parents, their genetic endowment seem to be rather unimportant for the political behavior. Whereas if you fast forward the case to these individuals now being 50 years of age, then we see that the social environment conditions are much smaller, whereas these biological factors are gaining in importance. The next one is instead comparing individuals who live with their parents and live without them. We see the same. When you live with your adoptive parents, the social environment is much more important than the genetics. But once you move out, that's starting to change. And here is a thing that they focused a lot on this in social learning theory in the 70s. They said that if you have really consistent cues, then the social learning should be more successful. So if you get really clear message from your parents what you should do, then it's more likely they're going to get the message and act on it. And that what we also see, that is if the consistent behavior or the pattern, so they always vote and never vote, or both the mother and father vote, then the social learning seems to be much more effective and much more important than it is if you get this kind of inconsistent cues. So this sort of another thing adds on that it's not that easy. So we have just this 40-60 split or 50-60 split. It could also vary across the life cycle. It could vary across the context that you are in. So that's why I think even more research is needed, obviously, because these are really complex things that we need to sort of dig into more. But at least I would like to think that it was somewhat of an important contribution to show that this kind of intergenerational political inequality has both biological and social roots. And it also suggests that this kind of literature that we historically had on this topic, they need to sort of work more together. So we have this traditional political socialization literature, we have this newer behavioral genetics literature, and I think if you only follow one of these routes, you're going to miss out on a lot of important things going on here. In order to really understand how political inequality in participation is reproduced across generations, we need sort of take the sort of the insights from both of these literature into account. And I think our studies were a small first step to actually do that. Even though I didn't say it at the time when I published these articles, I can say it now, that they're still very limited in many respects. One of the things they are limited in, as you saw, is the way they use this simple decomposition into nature and nurture. Obviously, in order to really understand this, we need to get more along, try to understand this interaction more than we actually did. We just sort of scrapped the surface on that, I would argue. So we need to understand that better. But another way, which I'm going to spend the rest of this lecture on, another limitation that both of these studies had, that they also shared with a lot of previous literature, or I actually say all the previous literature in the field, was that it was stuck, it was, we can call it the two-generation paradigm. That is, we only talked about parent and children. Okay, we spoke about biological and adoptive parents and children. But we still had this idea that political transmission is something that only occur from parents to children. We completely ignored and disregarded the role played by more distant ancestors. Couldn't it, for instance, be the case that grandparents or great-grandparents could also matter for how the children turn out, to what extent they participate in politics or not? And if that is the case, it opens up even more, and perhaps even more disturbing opportunities for these kind of persistence in political inequality across generations. Because then it will not only matter who our parents are, it could also matter how our grandparents are, or what their parents are, and their parents are. And the question is, where should we stop? So, before asking the question where we should stop, I guess we should ask the question, do they really have any good reasons for trying to pursue this kind of research? Actually, are there some reasons for trying to get out of this two-generational paradigm and consider multiple generations when doing these kind of exercises? And I guess they are both, I would argue, theoretical and methodological reasons to do that. Theoretically, there is a quote from sort of political scientist, probably the most well-known political science nowadays, Robert Putnam. He wrote a book on inequality in US in the 2016. And there he raised the possibility that grandparents were part of the story. And his argument for that was that grandparents today, he said, they're often more important in the grandchildren's life than the counterparts were half a century ago. because grandparents are healthier and wealthier than they used to be. So his argument was that since the grandparents are healthier, they live longer, they can spend more time with the grandchildren. And they're also more wealthier. So they open up these new possibilities that they can also impact the political behavior of the children. But there are also these methodological reasons to try to consider additional generation. And this might be a bit more technical. But if you have this idea that political inequality is only transmitted from one generation to another, you're going to have what in statistical parlance is called a first-order Markov chain. So that is the only thing going to matter is the state in the previous. The previous state is going to matter for the current state. So that's going to mean that even if we have a rather strong correlation between parents and the children, we can still have rather high political mobility in the long run because you have this kind of geometric decay where this changes rather quickly. So we have a stupid example. We can assume that the correlation between the parent and child is 0.3. Then, according to this two-generation paradigm, the expected correlation in voting between the child and his or her grandparents is going to be 0.3 raised to the power of 2. So they're just going to be 0.9, that correlation. And then we can do that one more step and look at the correlation between great-grandparents and great-grandchildren. That correlation is going to be 0.3 raised to the power of 3. That's only going to be 0.027. So that's just saying the fact that even if you have a strong correlation with parents and children, that correlation will not last for very long. And that's good news if we think that we should have high political mobility in the country. The problem is if grandparents or great parents can have this kind of direct influence on the great-grandchildren or grandchildren, then it can be shown that these two-generation view are going to underestimate the overall persistence in political inequality over time. So there's going to be excess persistence. For instance, what we're going to see then, if grandparents are important, we're going to see that the actual correlation we can measure in data between grandparents and grandchildren, that should be much higher than the one we should expect on this standard two-generation model. So that's what we set out to do in a paper that we recently published. And the question is, as I said, why should that matter? Obviously, state of transmission could work between grandparents and grandchildren. You can transfer your status to your grandchildren, so it can happen. Social learning. If you spend a lot of time with your grandchildren, you can act as a teacher and role model in the same way as parents can do. So in terms of these two mechanisms, I would argue that the difference between grandparents and parents is not one of kind, it's more one of the degree. They spend less time with the children. It's traditionally argued that we should not sort of need to consider genetic transmission in this case, because obviously transmission of genes are always passing the parents. So once we control for the identity of parents, there should no longer be any relationship between grandparents voting and the children's voting. But there is this influential argument by economic historian Gregory Clark, who argue that is not completely true. He argued that even if we have this kind of genetic transmission, but we have genetic transmission in things that we cannot observe, then that can give rise to this kind of exist persistence in different kind of mobility outcomes. So this is the model. I look at my watch and I see I should not get into the details, but if you're interested, you should read Gregory Clark, or you can read the paper, we try to explain this. But really what the saying is that if we have this kind of model where we actually control for parents' behavior, then we could find an effect of grandparents' behavior on the grandchildren's due to genetic transmission, if the genetic transmission followed this particular form that Gregory Clark portrays. So there is really no way, and I guess that's the problem, there is no way, if you just have data on these three generations, if you run the regression, the control for parents, we see that the voter turnout of the grandparents that matters for the grandchildren, there is no way, according to the data, to say whether or not that depends on the fact that the grandparents are actually influencing their grandchildren, for instance, through social learning, or if it's due to these kind of sort of genetic inheritance of latent traits. So what we tried to do in this study was to first of all ask the question, is there evidence of this kind of persistence? So is the sort of, for instance, the correlation in voting between grandchildren and grandparents, is that larger than what you expected from this simple two-generation model of voting transmission? And given that we found that, we were also interested in trying to say, can we say something about the mechanism giving rise to that exist persistence? And since coming from Sweden, having this data, we used these Swedish administrative registers. We have turnout data for, in this case, five elections, 1970, 82, 94, 2000, 2010, 2018. We link all individuals born 1970 to 2000 to the parents, grandparents, and in some cases, even great-grandparents. So we can, for about 1 million children, we can link them to three previous generations. We get this large panel of four generations. Or we have 2.7 million unique individuals who we can link to their parents and grandparents. And then we try to measure the voter turnout and see to what extent is that this kind of exists persistence. So the first way we do that is to estimate the standard autoregressive model. It's nothing fancy here. That is just the turnout of the child. This is the turnout of the parents. This is the turnout of the grandparents. These are socioeconomic controls, trying to get away later on for this status transmission and stuff like that. So if we just look at first the bivariate transmission coefficient, and here we have standardized them, so you can think of these as sort of partial correlation coefficients. So here we see that the transmission coefficient from parents to children is about 0.25. So if this were the entire story, then we should then expect that the correlation between grandparents and grandchildren should be about 0.25 raised to the power of 2. That's about 0.625. Looking at the actual correlation, we see that it's about 0.11. So that is the first indication that this kind of standard two-generation model is going to underestimate the long-run stability in political participation across these different generations. So it's just saying that if you're just looking at parents and children, you're going to underestimate the overall persistence in political participation in the long run. Then we see what happens if we enter these two in the same model, and obviously that some of this correlation between grandparents and grandchildren is due so do the parents. So what we see here is once we do this control, the transmission coefficient from grandparents to grandchildren is decreasing from 0.11 to about 0.05, so about cut in half. So half is going through the parents, but the other half is still sort of going directly, in this case, from grandparents to grandchildren. Here we control for the socioeconomic status of all generations, and then this correlation coefficient reduces by about a quarter. So about a quarter then could be attributed to this kind of social transmission, whereas the others sort of remain some kind of direct result of this kind of exist persistence in political participation across generations. Then we did the same for our larger sample, including four generations. There we see that in the bivariate, this blue one is the transmission coefficient for great-grandparents to their great-grandchildren. Just looking at the standard here, 0.25 raised to the power of 3. That's going to be a rather small number. I think it's 0.1 or something. The actual correlation here is 0.4. So the persistence that we see across these four generations is about 3 to 4 times as big as the one we should expected for this standard two-generation model. So we can still say that this impact is not huge. It's not that whether or not you vote is completely determined whether or not your great-grandparents used to vote. But we still see that this persistence is much higher than the one we should expect from this standard two-generation model. And it also sort of say that these more distant generations can be important. Once we control for this other stuff, most of it goes away. And it could be due to the fact that social learning is not the main mechanism, because very few of us spend a lot of time with our great-grandparents. So there could be more about other things. But what we see here is that, and what we argue here is, sort of this standard two-generation model that have dominated much previous research, including my own research on this topic, is problematic from the standpoint that it tend to underestimate the overall persistence in political inequality over time. So if a generation is hit by a shock that makes them much more likely to participate, that shock are staying on for much longer than we should expect that based on this standard two-generation model. So that's another thing I would argue, that in order to understand how political inequality is reproduced and maintained in democracies, we should also allow for the fact that this kind of inequality can span multiple generations. And in that sense, it makes it an even more difficult problem to combat, because it's not enough to target just the parents. In order to do something, you might also need to target the grandparents. Disregarding great-grandparents, even though I thought this result were interesting, I should also argue they are less important. So it's not that great-grandparents, once you really look at the data, they do not look super important. But the grandparents are, I would argue. The problem with these results is that they do not say very much about what this excess persistence come from. Does it come from this kind of genetic transmission of the Clark type, where parents transfer these latent traits to the children, or are they more due to social learning and sort of direct influence? The fact that we as grandparents can influence our grandchildren to behave in a certain way. The problem is, with this kind of data we have, we cannot distinguish these two. Both of them gonna give rise to this positive second order autoregressive coefficient. So we need to find some other way to try to disentangle that. We need to, similar to before, we need to shortcut either the genetic pathway, or we need to shortcut the social pathway and see what happens. And I guess you can already guess one of the things we do. We're going to reuse the adopted children, because then we can shortcut the genetic pathway. Now we're also going to use the natural adoptions, because we have more data on that. So they're simply going to sort of shortcut the genetic link between grandparents and grandchildren. But we're also going to do something else. We're going to study children whose grandparents died before they were born, because then they can't interact. So if we think that interaction is important, then we should see a bigger effect for the grandparents who are actually alive and spend time with the grandchildren than if you're only looking at grandparents as such. And if you do that, we have a different sample. These are the adoptees. So we see, first of all, we see that the correlation transmission coefficient of parents is about cut in half, similar to before. Just singular the fact that sort of transmission of parents is not only due to the social environment, it's also due to some kind of genetic factors. And we see that this green one, that is the the impact of grandparents in the adopted sample, and that reduces somewhat here in the bivariate. Goes from, it was 0.11, now it's 0.03 something, so it's two-thirds of a reduction in that coefficient. Here we see, this is the blue one, is the difference in transmission between living and dead grandparents. So this is another way to try to make it comparable. So this is the extra boost you get from having living grandparents rather than just having dead ones. So that blue bar should be due to this kind of social transmission and sort of interaction with the grandchildren. We see these green and blue ones are very similar in all models. So there are two different ways to try to get at the direct influence of grandparents on grandchildren, but they provide very similar results. And the overall message is that there is still remaining impact of grandparents on the grandchildren's voting, but that is smaller than it was before. It's about a third to 40% of the initial estimate we had on the previous slides. And one reason for that is that part of that, again, are due to these kind of sort of biological or pre-birth factors rather than social factors. But the social environment is also important. Somewhat less important for grandparents than it was for parents. But again, that is reasonable because as parents, we spend more time with our children than we do as grandparents. So I think that makes sense that that is the fact. So looking at the time, I see time to wrap up. So that is what I do. But as I said in the beginning, or might not have said that, but in pre-democratic societies, the identity of one's parents were the key to political power. That is, the chances to participate and influence politics was mainly an accident of birth. The promise of democracy, when it was first introduced 100 years ago in countries like Sweden and Finland, was that democracy is going to put an end to that. Family background was no longer to be the key to political power and influence. But if you look at the data, the kind of data I presented for you here today, we see that that promise has yet to be fulfilled. We can see the Bush, the Gandhis, the Trudeaus, and the Le Pens. There are signs that family background still matter for political influence and political participation. And to some extent, which we have also seen during this lecture and tried to understand, that is not that surprising because these are very complex phenomena that depends on a lot of things. I've tried to show that it both involves multiple generations. We have seen that this kind of persistence can have both social and biological roots. So obviously it's going to take a lot to change this for real. But just because something is difficult doesn't mean that something is impossible. And that's what we're going to learn tomorrow. For tomorrow, as I said, I promise, it's going to be a bit more constructive. Then we're going to try to see, are there ways we can try to mitigate the importance of family background in modern democracy? And I can just tell you that the answer is going to be partly a yes. Not completely a yes, but partly a yes. But if you want to know more about that, then you have to be here tomorrow as well. So for those of you that are interested, see you tomorrow.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.